with Irv Luton in the Jefferson Room at the Oregon Historical Center. The date is November 2nd, 1989. The interviewer is Jim Strassmayer for the Oregon Historical Society. So one of our earlier subjects was the major subject we talked about at great length was the timber tax issue that at one point did get resolved but continued to be an issue, and you had evidently some further thoughts about that later history of taxation.
Well, I thought I should add that even after the timber tax laws were changed in 1961 with the passage of House Bill 1114 and House Bill 1438, and one of those bills affected timber on the west side and one on the east side. There were two different methods. Even after those were passed, the passage of those bills remained a controversial thing because the Department of Revenue would compute each year what would have been brought in revenue from timber had no change been made. In other words, if the law that was in effect prior to the passage of these bills would have brought in more revenue because timber would have been taxed higher than it was after the passage of these bills. And some legislators would focus on this and say, well, maybe we shouldn't have passed those, we shouldn't have made this change in the timber tax laws, because look what's being lost in revenue. The ironic thing about that was that maybe it isn't ironic, but it was a false perception of what would have been a fair method of taxing timber. The law that existed prior to the passage of those laws would have placed an excessive burden on timber and would over time have increased the excessiveness of that burden. So the legislators who focused on the amount that the old law would have brought in relation to what the new law brought in, we're really looking at something that was not that really you couldn't make a fair judgment on. And so it was always a problem of explaining that the law that had existed prior to the passage of these two bills in 1961 was placing an unfair burden on timber, and not only unfair, but it would have made timber growing impossible in the future. And we always had to explain that this to new legislators that hadn't gone through all of the consideration of the timber tax bill. We had to explain that to them so that they would understand this. And then there were some legislators who principally, one from Clackamas County, who...
Who was that? Can you think? Well, we can identify him later.
Who every session would bring this up and say, look at what happened. We should never have passed this because look at all the revenue that's being lost. And so you'd have to try to bring this thing into perspective every session. This was Dick Groner, who
Dick Groner. Senator all right, Groner. I thought it was going to be Dick.
And he blamed me for having He said I had lied to him on this subject, but I really hadn't. And maybe he sincerely believed this, but I hadn't. I had explained to him that the new laws would not bring in as much as the old law, but it would, that is in the future. Mm-hmm. But the amount that the new laws would bring in when these laws were passed would amount to the same amount that had been received in the previous year before their passage. So it was a sort of a complicated subject. Mm-hmm. What he was looking at is that the old law had a climbing levy against timber. And so the farther out you got, the bigger was the spread between what would have been brought in by the old law and what the new law brought in. And he would look at that and say, well, look what happens, you know. And so it was always a problem. And then after they got the severance tax passed in 19, that was House Bill 3874 in 1977. I think after that, there wasn't so much of that skepticism about whether the laws should have been changed. I think it was becoming better understood then. But every session, we were forced to do a lot of work to try to put the thing in perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I made clear what the problem really was. The discount that was applied to the true cash value of timber would have been decreased over the years under the old law, until finally it was trending to a situation where all timber would be placed on the rolls at true cash value as if it were for sale tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. It was really aimed at that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if you looked at that and how much money that would have raised, mm-hmm. it of course would have raised much more in the future mm-hmm. than would be raised with these new laws.
Uh-huh.
And that was the thing that was being criticized. And so we had to put that in perspective by pointing out that if we had followed the old law, you couldn't have held on to timber. You had to cut it all, and it was doubtful whether you could afford to grow it.
Mm-hmm. Well, had Groner been around with the earlier legislation?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And didn't at that time was one of the arguments for the change in taxation. To bring relief to timber face of that
yes.
growing
yes, but however
weight.
You had other pressures, uh-huh. you see, from there were some school districts that felt they would lose money. There were county officials that felt they'd lose money by a change in the timber tax mm-hmm. law. So you had those kinds of pressures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that probably covers that subject well enough. Uh-huh.
The severance tax in 1977, it replaced primarily the previous method of taxation?
Yes, yes, uh-huh. yes. Before that it was an ad valorem system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was sort of a combination. It was an ad valorem system, and then in the year that you cut, it was in effect the severance mm-hmm. tax. Mm-hmm. And the timber that you cut, in the current year, you paid an additional tax on it.
Right.
So it was sort of a combination.
Yeah. Isn't that whole situation complicated by the log export situation, and also by Canadian? Well, better take one thing at a time.
Well, I don't think. At the time, the timber tax laws were being considered, log export was practically non-existent.
Uh-huh.
There was some export of cedar, Port Arthur cedar, to Japan, but that was minor, and no one ever questioned it. The log export question came along later, and that came along as when I can't give you an exact date of when that became an issue, but there were companies and loggers who were looking at the Elliott State Forest as a source of logs, and then those companies that did not own timber, the so-called small operators, who were in the Western Forest Industries Association, were the ones that raised the question about log exports, when logs started to be exported. And they saw two things that could happen. One was that they would have to bid higher for timber. Again, they have to bid against the Japanese interest. That meant that that would affect their profit. Secondly, they thought there could be a timber shortage. And then the environmentalists got into the picture because they didn't want more timber cut. And so they viewed it from the standpoint that if logs are being exported, that means that more logs are going to be cut to serve the domestic market. Because if you didn't export those logs, those would be available to mills here for the domestic market. And so they were opposed to it. Yet it became an issue in which I think the small mills that didn't, the small companies that didn't own their own timber and were relied on public timber and what private timber they could buy, I kind of lost track of what I was going to say.
Well, the small companies that was there, they were the ones who had the main concern in the earlier stages of things.
Yes. And I think Western Forest Industries Association was the one that really brought this issue to the fore.
Mm-hmm. Well, the overriding question, I guess, that began to form as the debate began to generate about you know, what was left and what needed to be saved and so forth, but the overall, aside from the debate, there's the reality of how much timber is out there, how fast is it going,
right.
the resource, how, what's happening to the resource, aside from what's going on outside, the different voices, you know, from different points of view and different interests, how about within the company? Was there a certain range in the discussion about the resource?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think that affected the right rate of cut on Weyerhaeuser land. If we could use it domestically, we used it domestically, and if it was a better market for export, we exported. And I doubt that made much difference. I don't know for sure, but I doubt that it made any difference in the rate of cut on Weyerhaeuser land. I think that rate of cut was established like a budget, and if you found a better market in export, it went export.
Mm-hmm. So there was, it was pretty sure inside the company
there was any controversy inside the company,
uh-huh.
because it was recognized that that export of logs was profitable enough that it really provided the capital base for Weyerhaeuser's forestry program. Mm-hmm. Weyerhaeuser could not have done as much in forestry research and forest management as it did without having that good market.
Because mm-hmm. that was a very strong yes. profit from. Yes. from did you ever meet David Mason and Father's Sustained Yield?
Oh, yes.
In what circumstances?
Well.
Do you recall that?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, during this timber tax controversy, David Mason took the position that there should be a very low tax on timber. And we were trying, when I say we, Weyerhaeuser and the other companies that were trying to get the timber tax laws changed, were trying to get Willamette, the support of Willamette Industries. And David Mason was their consultant, and what he wanted was unrealistic. You never could have got it passed because what he was arguing for was a tax so low that it would never have been acceptable. Mm-hmm. We had to face reality in this thing because if you reduce the tax in timber too much, you knew that there would be school districts, counties that would have less revenue, and the political repercussions of that would have made it impossible mm-hmm. to ever get the timber tax laws changed. Or if you did get them changed and they suffered this loss, the law would be repealed, and then perhaps the timber owners would even be punished for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because what you are likely to get was something like an initiative measure or something like uh-huh. that. So you had to face the political reality.
Uh-huh. So he wasn't being politically realistic.
Pardon?
He wasn't being politically realistic.
No, he wasn't. And I talked to him many times during those years. And he eventually, Willamette Industries did come around to the position that the rest of the
so he was very influential.
Wanted to change the law, but we never really got the wholehearted support that we hoped we would get because of Dave Mason's influence.
He was so influential.
Oh yes, he was quite influential with Willamette Industries.
Did you understand where he was coming from? Was he just being politically naive, or what was his rationale?
Well, his rationale was strictly economic, and if you looked at his rationale carefully, you could support it, because from an economic standpoint, when it took so long to grow timber and you had all the costs of growing timber, what he was saying made sense. But it was politically unrealistic. Well, there were others that had unrealistic positions like that. Brooks Scanlon and Gilchrist had positions like this. As a matter of fact, in 1959, I could have got the timber law tax law passed through the House if Gilchrist and Brooks Scanlon, Al Glasso was the manager, Brooks Scanlon, and Al Glasso and Frank Frank Gilchrist were absolutely opposed to any kind of an ad valorem tax on timber. And if there was going to be any change, although they had an ad valorem tax on timber, but they were opposed to any change that would not be a severance tax. And so when that bill came on the floor, the representatives from Bend and Gilchrist timber area voted against the bill. And yet they want to change. They want to change too, as badly as we did. But they didn't want that kind of a change. They wanted the severance tax or nothing.
Yeah.
There was another person, a former professor at Oregon State. Oh, I wish I could remember these names. Who had started buying timber when he was a professor. And he accumulated small tracts of timber till he had a whale of a big tree farm.
I remember you mentioning him.
Yeah, what is his name?
But I don't remember his name.
Pardon?
I don't remember his name either.
Gosh, I thought of it after you and I talked about it.
Well, perhaps it'll come back. Well, David Mason.
Starker. And he didn't want an ad valorem tax either. Well, he had his own idea about what kind of a tax we ought to have, and it was also politically unrealistic. And so he controlled the legislator, one of the legislators from Polk County, and those were all votes that we lost, you see. And we spent a lot of time talking with these people like Starker and Dave Mason and trying to point out the political realities, but they wouldn't budge.
Well, how did David Mason expect to keep from running through the resource? What did he understand would prevent us from actually overcutting and ending up with a depleted resource?
Well, I think he felt too. He wanted change too, but he didn't want that kind of change. He felt that we could get what his idea of a tax system would be, but it was unrealistic. Well, Lavin Industries finally came around, and their lobbyist, Sam Robb, helped us on getting the laws changed in later years. But in the first two go-arounds in 57 and 59, they weren't helpful.
But if one of his purposes, David Mason's purposes, is sustained yield, how did he think that was going to happen? Through the enlightenment of the individual companies, or through state controls, or what?
Oh,
for replanting and.
Oh, no, you're talking about not about taxes then.
No, I'm talking about cutting policy, and to make sure that the resource is not depleted.
Yeah. Well. He was a strong advocate of sustained yield. There's no question about that. And I think most of the major companies were. I don't think they differed with Mason on that score. Weyerhaeuser, Crown Zellerbach, Willamette Industries, International Paper, Medford Corporation. Gilchrist Timber Company, Brooks Gatlin, were all, I think, in tune with Mason on a long-range cutting plan that would maintain sawmills over the years, maintain think there was disagreement on that. As a matter of fact, there was some almost horror, I think, when Georgia-Pacific started to cut so rapidly among the ranks of those people, because they felt that this, we might get, the timber industry might get regulated either by the state or the federal government if this kind of cutting went on. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it, as it turned out, there wasn't that much public outcry about it. Mm-hmm. And I think Willamette Industries and Brooks Gavin and Gilchrist Timber Company and Weyerhaeuser have not cut indiscriminately. I think Weyerhaeuser stepped up its cut somewhat, mm-hmm. because it, over what it, the cut was when I first joined the company. Because at that time they were considering that it took about 80 years to grow a Douglas fir to harvest size, and through research and changes in the processing of timber, mm-hmm. Products, product changes, they came to the conclusion that you could cut somewhat more rapidly. So I don't know how much Weyerhaeuser did step up his cut, mm-hmm. and what the final effect was, because I've been out of the company for some time. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Weyerhaeuser or Brooks Gallen or Gilchrist Timber Company or International Paper really changed their policy all that much.
They still believed in sustained yield.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it depends on what you mean by sustained yield. Mm-hmm. But certainly in Weyerhaeuser, the feeling that I always got up to the time that I retired was that the company was looking at it as a long-range mm-hmm. business where you would have a continuous cycle. Mm-hmm. That does not mean that you would just have the same amount of cut each year, because one of the factors in the Weyerhaeuser policy was that if you have a good market year, cut somewhat more. Mm-hmm. And then in the downturn, mm-hmm. when housing starts are down, cut less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. When you say it depends on what you mean by sustained yield, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are a lot of different definitions of it. It's always been somewhat fuzzy, I think. I'm not sure I can explain that. But some people look at sustained yield as being on a 100-year cycle or an 80-year cycle, and they never varied from that. And you cut the same amount each year, no matter what the market conditions were.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder, another variant in that is in looking at the whole resources, whether you're talking about sustained yield in terms of your own holdings or sustained yield in terms of the resource that's available, including yeah. government timber.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that is a factor, too, in Weyerhaeuser's calculations, or has been, I should say.
I don't really think so. I really don't know. Uh-huh. But from what I gathered through the years, Weyerhaeuser was chiefly concerned with its own mm-hmm. resource, except at Klamath Falls, where about 50% of, no, 25% of the cut, I think, was mm-hmm. from public land. Mm-hmm. And that that was a continuing thing. We cut our service and then the rest from our own land. Mm-hmm. undoubtedly, the forestry department must have looked at what timber was available in the Forest Service and other public lands. Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to depend on doing some buying of federal timber.
Yes, I think so. And mm-hmm. they always did in the state of Washington. The warehouses always bought timber from the state, because there were a lot of state lands that were adjacent to Weyerhaeuser lands or checkerboarded with them. And historically, it always bought some timber from the state. And undoubtedly, what was available there was taken into consideration in our own cut. But I don't have a lot of information on that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another subject that